This is an interview with Governor Attia. This is K-13 Side 2.
So this strike continues to go. When it's over, Martin Franks has some season left, if we want to use that term. In terms of the farmer, he's got a harvest time, and that's the time they're going to strike. You know, there's no point striking in the wintertime. They can last, they can hang on until harvest time. So that's when they're going to strike. And if they're unable to harvest their crop, their whole year is gone. Mm-hmm. See, Martin Frank still has some years, some part of the year left. The farmer doesn't have any part of the year left. And so, you know, okay, collective bargaining, let's talk about it, let's see what the problems are, let's see if we can iron them out, that kind of thing. But in terms of striking, you just kill off the farmer. And obviously that's not what we want to do. The guy's badly enough and dead as it is. And so in terms of my personal philosophy, I was willing to go part of the way, but I wasn't willing to go all the way. Mm-hmm. And but that's the reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Part of that issue also was in regards to letting public employees and teachers have the right to strike as well. How did you feel about that?
Well, I that's very difficult because, again, I think in terms of bargaining, it's an important thing that should happen. At the same time, there are services that are required by Oregonians. We have to have prison guards. You know, you can't have them walk out. Of course, that was never the case. Whenever they talked about striking, those kinds of folks couldn't strike. People on welfare need assistance. You know, there's things that have to keep government going. So I was willing to go part of the way, maybe even to allow striking and what let me call it non-essential, life-threatening or that kind of thing in those areas. And that's not too bad. Of course, they had the power to strike and they threatened strike while I was governor. And we had a contingency plan all drafted up in the event that it ever happens. But by and large, there are things that you can't, you know, government is there. I've said many times that, you know, the business, you said run government like a business, and I think by and large you can do that. But there are some exceptions. For example, I would say, you know, a company might go broke. They close their doors. But government can never close their doors. We don't have that option. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We got to stay open. No matter what happens, we got to stay open. And I guess basically the same idea in terms of striking. We've got to stay open. We're serving the public of the state of Oregon for many, many things. So, you know, to make it operate as well as possible, to do the things that Oregonians need, at the same time give a public employee, just because they're a public employee, to deny them opportunities to bargain, to you know, to talk about what their problems might be. I don't think they should be denied that.
One of the biggest issues that came up during this session was Senate Bill 100, mm-hmm. on the creation of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, LCDC.
Not 71, you got to be in another year.
Was that in 73 then?
Well, 73 was Senate Bill 10 and 75 was Senate Bill 100.
Oh, so maybe then I'm off a session. Maybe that was in 1973 then. You were on that committee, weren't you?
I was on the committee, yeah.
That was Hector McPherson, wasn't it?
That's correct. Well, Hector was Senate Bill 100.
Senate Bill 100, yes, that was
in
the 73 session.
Yeah, Senate Bill 10 was a session before.
Right.
And right. Senate Bill 10 said, you have to, local government, you have to have a land use planning. And if you don't, we will. That's what 10 said. I'm obviously paraphrasing it. And they didn't do it to somebody's satisfaction, and so Senate Bill 100 came along.
Why was there resistance on that? That was for by county, wasn't it?
Yeah, counties, cities, and counties, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we'd operated for a long time. I have to tell you that in a very practical way, I would say to people, they over-dramatize it. I'm glad we have land use planning, and I've defended it, and it's been on the ballot, and I've opposed eliminating it. All of that's all history. Mm-hmm. And yet I would say to them, well, tell me about the rape and pillage out there. You know, we've been operating since 1859 without Senate Bill 100. Now, where's the rape and pillage that's going on? Well, maybe 82nd Street. Certainly Raleigh Hills, where I live. But, by and large, it's been responsible development in the state of Oregon. What we've done with Senate Bill 100 is to assure there won't be a disorderly development. And that's good, and that's why I've defended it and why I voted for it, incidentally. But I was trying to put it in the right perspective. Yeah, we got a problem, we got to deal with it. But, the way the whole message came is, we're going to hell in a handbasket. Tom McCall, again talking about his charisma, he talked about Charbonitis. And there was a need for what we had to do.
Well, there were some controversies at the time about places like the 20 Miracle Miles, which people refer to as the Tom, 20 Miserable Miles.
That's what Hatfield said that. Hatfield said
out
that.
Out on the coast by Lincoln City.
Yeah, and Lincoln City.
And then there was land speculation deal out in Central Oregon near Bend that became very controversial because it was...
In this case, it did not fit, but it is true if you look at the history of some of the things the state does, probably more what the federal government does, the saying, hard cases make bad law, is indeed true. I'm not saying that really applied to. These were just used as good examples of what bad things could happen, meaning Bend and wherever else that we're talking about. But it didn't mean that was proliferated all over the state of Oregon. And in this case, we get hard cases made good law, I think. But quite often, hard cases do make bad law. They point to one thing, and then they're going to solve that one thing, and they make some pretty bad law out of it.
Redistricting and apportionment was an issue that term, and the Oregonian said that Senate President Burns had certain goals for the session. He only lost one of the big ones, and that was reapportionment. Is that just a sort of a perennial issue, but an issue that comes up every at least once
every,
a decade?
Every 10 years, yes.
And everything is the same about it, or does it change from decade to decade?
Well, it changes. And I think it seems to me that 71, I think I'm sure I'm right. There have been some Supreme Court cases, one man, one vote. And that they never really defined it. In other words, how big an error could you have? Could you be 1% off, 2% off? And so you got a little bit more mathematical with 71 in making sure that as the districts were developed, number one, that they were, I think, I don't recall, we thought probably an error of 1% or 2% was okay. Because, you can't make it just precisely perfect. But it was very mathematical. But always, particularly legislative, it wouldn't make any difference statewide. But you have two things involved, the House, the Senate, and Congress. Mm-hmm. And those were the districts you were trying to put together. And the Democrats are looking for what the registrations are, and the Republicans are looking at the same. And you try not to get too much out of whack. The Republicans are kind of looking over the shoulder of the Democrats, and Democrats the Republicans. And at the same time, those that are now in the legislature are looking as to what's happening to their seat and whether they're going to be district lines are going to boot them out. So that's all. This is all of the energy that's going on during the course of the debate of reapportionment.
There was another issue which came up from time to time and during the session, and that was on the fluoridation of water. Seems like that used to be a really big issue. You don't hear anything about it anymore.
Yeah. I suppose it's because of fluoride toothpaste. Well, that really was a hot issue. There's been a lot of unremembered, but at the time, really hot issues, and that was one of them. And we talked earlier about sex education. That was another one at one time. And whether or not we should put things in our water, and there are those that thought we ought not to do it. There were those that would give examples of what could happen if people were drinking fluoride and with terrible things to your body. And the dentists, on the other hand, said it was good for your teeth and you ought to have it. And it was a kind of a big issue because we don't have too much fluoride in our water in Oregon, and certainly we don't in this metropolitan area at Bull Run. So it got to be emotional. We started dealing with our bodies and what goes in them. And I can recall a fellow from Newburgh, and he was very uptight about this whole thing, and it brought a variety of people into the foray. It didn't pass. Finally decided, no, we're not going to do that.
How did you feel about it?
I didn't think we ought to do that. You know, you can take your children to the dentist and they can fluoride their mouth. Why force everybody to? There was a way you could get the job done if you really were concerned about it.
Going back to some agricultural issues, there was a Senate Bill 294 which would limit the liability of agricultural landowners in 1971. It would allow owners to allow the public to come on to private lands for recreational purposes. Representatives Keith Burns and Keith Skelton said it would abolish the legal doctrine of attractive nuisance by removing liability. Was this part of what was happening around the issues of the Willamette Greenway?
Willamette Greenway was one, but by and large, this was indeed the case. And trying to get people to allow public on your land. They were, as we are today, concerned about being sued. If you slip and break your leg, you get sued because I'm on this guy's property. He'd let the mud stay there or that, whatever the... And of course, these plaintiff attorneys are looking for ways to sue people. But in order to really open up an opportunity for a lot of land that wasn't public land, but for the public to go on, I think it was essential that we limit that liability. Then say, okay, the guy doesn't have an excuse, except I don't want you on my land. But other than that, you can't say, well, I don't want you on there because I don't want to be sued. Ergo, it's all blocked off. And so that's not bad legislation.
Were there other issues that that you recall during that session that were of great significance? Things that you were particularly involved with? Things that you were particularly involved with?
I can't
maybe
recall.
There was a Senate bill in 1971 to merge Portland with Multnomah County. That's an interesting concept in terms of what now is happening with Metro, the regional council, and people just passed an initiative regarding that. What were your feelings on the time on this issue?
I think, again, if I recall our discussion, that government closest to the people is the best, and the more remote you make it, or put it another way, bigger is not better. And it's hard for me to remember all of what we said, but I happen to believe that democracy is not an efficient form of government. They're talking about efficiencies, and you have to live with some inefficiency in order to retain a democracy. Mm-hmm. That's my personal philosophy. I know we talked about it because we talked about philosophies. Right.
There was also a Senate vote to give 18-year-olds the vote. What happened with that?
If I recall correctly, that was made into initiative referred to the people for a vote. There are a lot of arguments about that. It was another controversial subject. I think the people turned it down.
I remember part of the issue was and I think that we did talk about this a little bit, because Burns went on to be the governor in absentia, and then Harry Boyven took over as Senate president and tried to manipulate this issue on the 18-year-old vote as a president pro tem, and he appointed two extra members to his elections committee. One regular member of the committee leaves when the topic is announced, and leaving the committee without a quorum. It seems a rather odd set of circumstances. Do you remember when that happened?
I don't recall, but I do recall a great deal of controversy about the 18-year-old vote.
Mm-hmm. Were you in favor of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I believe that it was then ratified.
Yeah. I can't recall sequence of time, but I do recall it was extremely controversial in the legislative body, and I was supportive of it. I was not supportive of the next step, which is drinking at 18 and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of vote, I thought that was an appropriate thing.
There was also a bill to delete constitutional prohibition of gambling and lotteries. Of course, this was long before we had a lottery, but where were you on that?
I voted no on every single gambling, lottery, whatever. In this case, pure as a driven snow. I oppose it. I've always opposed it. I opposed the lottery when it was on the ballot when I was governor. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the state should be a beneficiary of people gambling, and I think that there's an awful lot of people. I don't think it's exclusive, but there are a whole lot of people that have this great yearning to get out of the fix they're in, and they're going to do it by gambling, and they can least afford it. Mm-hmm. So I've been opposed to it.
There was another bill to eliminate the concept of fault in divorce. I'm not sure if this is one of the ones that Betty Roberts sponsored.
Probably. It's no fault.
Yeah.
Quite a few appropriate, I think, legislation of creating equality and between men and women.
Burns called the 71 session the People's Legislature. I think in part because he felt that a lot of things were passed that were of consumer orientation, and there were certain changes that were taking place in the legislature at that time. How do you look back on that session in that period?
I can't. Then one merges into another. Clark, I can't recall. Everybody tries to designate things, puts the best face on it. I can't dispute it or confirm it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you work with Bob Smith very much? I know that.
You mean now Congressman Bob Smith?
Now Congressman, but who at the time was in the House, wasn't he? He was Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. What is the relationship of a Republican Speaker of the House to a minority leader Republican in the Senate? Is there sort of a cooperation between the
two?
Yeah,
there is. And of course, we've got that now. Mm-hmm. We have a Republican Speaker with a minority Senate. But in my case, it's not just the typical. I know Bob very well. He was one of the Turks, as we talked about earlier. We talk as friends as well as what's going on. I do remember. I don't remember the bill, but I do remember some bill that Bob Smith couldn't hang on to. and he didn't like at all. And it was now in the Senate. No, it was a Senate bill he didn't like. He didn't want to have it in the House. That was it. And I said, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. So when the vote came on this particular bill that Bob Smith didn't want, I went around and talked to all my Republicans. Except one.
Who was that?
Tom Artung. Who really didn't have any strong feelings about it, but it was his vote that got the darn thing passed out of the Senate after I had assured Bob. I talked with Tom later and I said, gee whiz, I just never thought, I didn't talk to him because I never believed he'd ever vote for it. He said, oh, I don't know, I didn't really care one way or another.
In that case, can you vote for a reconsideration or?
Well, yeah, but I went over to tell Bob, God, Bob, I mean, I really had this thing nailed. I would never have believed it, and I've forgotten what happened, but he got a bill that he didn't really want after I assured him, you know, with great fervor that I was going to take care of it. And it was just because I talked to everybody, but I never thought that Tom would ever vote the way he did. I just thought, well, I'm not going to bother to talk to Tom. No point in talking with Tom. And Tom is the guy I should have talked to.
When you decide that you're going to do something like that, prevent some bill from going through, what is your strategy? I mean, I'm sure it depends on what it is, but are you only speaking with Republicans at that point, or are you trying to, if you're
it
in
depends,
a minority?
Yeah,
you,
it depends on how you size it up. You know, you say, okay, if it just needs a Republican, that's all I would talk to. Then my next step would be talk to friendly Democrats, and I obviously have quite a few of those. And I'd appreciate it if you'd vote no, you know, and explain to them what my problem would be and get some assurances. And incidentally, this would be a good time to talk about it because of the gradual changes that happened. And in my early days and for a good part of my tenure in the legislature, somebody said yes or they said no. You could take that to the bank. Later on, and particularly the years I was governor, that no longer existed. Mm-hmm. I can recall when I, as governor, I was asking Lee Johnson, how many votes do we have? And he said 18, whether it be against or for, I don't remember. And my answer to him was, that's not enough. Now, clearly 18 is enough. All you need are 16 in the Senate. But so things had changed that much. You could not depend. When somebody said they were going to vote one way or another, you could depend on it. Now that's not the case anymore. That's too bad.
Mm-hmm. In the case of trying to develop a strategy for preventing some bill from going through, do you run the risk when you cross over and talk to Democrats of perhaps generating a partisan opposition to it?
Oh, sure, but you understand all of that. Uh-huh. And it a lot depends on what you know, what your approach is, to whom you talk to, those that you have confidence in, can trust, and it's not necessarily Republicans. You know, Republican goes south on you. I say south in terms of what my views would be versus what theirs would be. So you know, you develop a friendship and an understanding and trust among people and. Mm-hmm. There's some that you don't because they just are much too partisan. But you know who they are. So you just.
How much
is
the
beauty, incidentally, of the Senate? You only need 16. See, in the House, you need 31.
Right. How much of your honor do you feel is at stake when you commit yourself, say, in this case, to Speaker Smith, that you're going to accomplish something in the Senate? As minority leader, or just as a friend, how much do you feel is at stake there?
All of it. I mean, very much like if I commit to vote, that is a commitment. It's your own credibility is at stake, and you know, one slip is all you need to eliminate credibility. If a legislator doesn't keep their commitment once, their credibility's gone. I mean, henceforth, once is enough. The same thing with lobbyists. The lobbyist deliberately gives you the wrong information. That's it. It's finished. I don't need two. One's enough. So I apply that to myself. You see, in other words, it works both ways. I feel a commitment is a commitment.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the people that you worked most closely with during that period in the legislature while you were minority leader?
I really have to.
I would think that as minority leader, you were probably an integral part of forming.
Most, if not all, the Republicans. There was some that were hard to convince. Certainly, John Burns and Mike Thorne. I think Mark was there at the time. I had a good relationship with Dick Roener, and I can't recall all who were there. Mm-hmm. Those were Democrats I'm talking about now. If I had a list of who was there at the time, I could tell you.
Sure. How did you communicate with your own constituency? What did you have a newsletter or did you have meetings planned that you would go to?
No, some of them have their town halls once a month or something like that. No, I didn't have anything like that.
Were you often invited to town hall meetings?
No. Once in a while. It wasn't eliminated altogether, but I didn't have any particular routine. I'd go back and talk to our Public Affairs Forum or the local Rotaries or chambers, and when I was invited to come, I'd go do that. Talk to the newspapers, the Hillsborough Argus and the Forest Grove News Times and the Beaverton Valley News and things of that kind. But it wasn't formalized in a sense. So I would go whenever I was invited to do it.
Were there groups that you were closely involved with? Groups or organizations that you were closely involved with?
No. Mm-hmm.
Legislatively?
No.
How did you feel that your relationship with the media was while you were in the legislature?
Oh, always good. Always good. I always like the media. I get mad at them every once in a while, but that's just sort of a routine. But I always enjoyed them.
Were there places off the floor that you went to discuss with legislators various topics? And
no particular designated place. Mm-hmm. I'd go to wherever they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of, if you're in committee, you can talk about whatever it is you have in mind. Wherever you have a chance to meet with them, if you had something in mind. Sometimes you go look them up wherever they were.
Mm-hmm. Were there setbacks or controversies or disappointments you had as a senator in the legislature?
The answer is yeah. But if you're going to say when or what time or when, I couldn't answer it. But sure, that's always the case. Always the case.
I know that you've mentioned several times your disappointment in not having been chosen to run for the Senate presidency by your party. Were there other things like that to you? Goals?
The answer is yes, but I don't want to overplay it. Mm-hmm. Because it was more embarrassing than it was any particular anger. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to rise me to anger. That just happened to be my own physical and psychological makeup. Matter of fact, I hate to get angry in the sense that I kind of lose it a little bit, and I don't like to lose it. I like to always be at least somewhat in command of myself. And if I get really angry, I lose it, and I don't like that. So in terms of that particular instance, I'm sure a lot of it was done vindictively toward me by people that really became very close friends.